ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to Big Ideas. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Last night, Big Ideas and ABC TV brought you a live simulcast of a special national forum hosted by David Spears, a town hall style event on anti-Semitism and the Jewish experience in Australia. If you missed it and our broadcast, catch up with our podcast or watch it on ABC iView. Well, today on Big Ideas, we dive a little deeper still with an exploration of the religious roots of anti-Semitism. And from ABC Radio National's Religion and Ethics team, Andrew West and Scott Stevens are on board with guests. Together, they're investigating an ancient prejudice, its origins and its evolution.
Over the last 2.5 years, we've seen a surge of anti-Semitism, certainly abroad, but also at home, and most confrontingly, during the Hanukkah celebration at Bondi Beach in December. But the roots of anti-Jewish contempt run deep. I'm Andrew West. Together with my colleague Scott Stevens, we're exploring where this animosity originates, how it spread, the damage it's done, and where it's taking us.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. Anti-Jewish hatred is, of course, older than Christianity, but it was that split between Judaism and Christianity, and then later with the emergence of Islam, that created the fault lines that exist to this day, from the depiction of Jews as Christ killers to the medieval blood libel, from the horrors of the Holocaust to viral anti-Semitic memes.
Judaism itself, of course, has lots of disagreement, room for lots of rival movements. But what made Christianity so different from other Jewish movements, so irreconcilable, that they had to split? Amy Jill Levine, AJ, is Professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies. So, AJ, what's the answer?
There are multiple answers, and if we try to reduce this very difficult question to simple sound bites, we're going to be unfaithful to history as well as to theology. So the short answer is that Christianity concluded that the only way truth and life happened to be Jesus, and then it had to explain why the majority of the Jewish people, Jesus' own people, did not sign on to the program. So either they were misled, or at some point in the future when Jesus came back, they would get with the program. Or for the Gospel of John, they are children of the devil and they were predestined never to get it. The easiest way to explain the Jewish no is to say there's something wrong with them spiritually and eventually biologically, and then we get Jewish racism.
There seem to be, as we look at the New Testament, the fundamental part of the Christian scripture, there are these two strands. There's a sort of a universalist strand, even egalitarian. There's no distinction between Jew and Gentile or male and female. There's another strand, though, that really doesn't like Jews. They talk about hypocrisy and their attachment to the law. Which school of thought ultimately prevailed?
It's not so much that there's no distinction between Jew and Gentile. There is no Jew and Gentile, and there is no male and female. Christianity eventually had to become exclusivistic rather than universalistic. Or if we call it universalistic, it's universalism on its own terms. As long as everybody believes in Jesus, then they're fine. That's not a universalistic model. That's a very, very particular one. Jews, on the other hand, always retained a sense of an ethnic community. So that Jews did not generally care whether one believed in the God of Israel or not, because one did not have to convert to Judaism in order to be in a right relationship with God. One was supposed to act in a morally appropriate way.
And isn't this especially true with the Jewish Pharisees? Tell me about this Jewish sect. Jesus rebukes them in the New Testament. He says they follow the letter of the law, but not its spirit. And for the 2,000 years since, some Christians have used the Pharisees as a justification for anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish prejudice.
That's certainly the way it's been interpreted. Pharisees becomes a cipher for Jews, and then the traits attributed to the Pharisees by select New Testament writings then become attributed to all Jews, particularly from the Gospel of Matthew chapter 23, a series of invectives, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you do pretty much everything wrong and then some. But we also have in the New Testament quite nice Pharisees. The only Pharisee from whom we've got written records happens to be St. Paul. We've got the lovely Nicodemus in the Gospel of John and the equally lovely Gamaliel in the book of Acts. And the sad thing is that when we actually go back and do the history of the Pharisees, it turns out they're the liberalizers at the time. They try to adapt the law to make it easier to follow. And they're the more egalitarian group who resist priestly privilege. That's why they're interested in hand washing, for example, because that's what priests do in the temple. And Pharisees said, in effect, you should all be a kingdom of priests in a holy nation. So Pharisees got a very, very bad reputation in Christianity. At the same time, Jews came to recognize Pharisees as our spiritual forebears. The good news here is that in 2019, there was a major conference co-sponsored by the Pontifical Biblical Institute in Rome on who were the Pharisees. We have an article by Pope Francis who said, stop picking on the Pharisees and do not use the Pharisees as a negative cipher to speak of all Jews. Go do the history and we're much better off.
AJ, fascinating to hear you refer there to Pope Francis and what he said about the Pharisees. It's not necessarily new, this reconciliation. It was only 60 years ago that millions and millions of Catholics around the world, it's within living memory, used to pray for the perfidious Jew. But they changed all that quite radically after the Second Vatican Council in the early 1960s. And there was a document called Nostra Aetate, meaning in our time. How significant was this?
Nostra Aetate came out in October of 1965, so a little over 60 years ago. It created a sea change in Catholic religious education. Jews were no longer to be understood as being accursed by God. Anti-Semitism was proclaimed incompatible with Catholic teaching. The continuity between Jesus and his Jewish context was affirmed. And Jews at all times and places were not to be understood to be Christ killers. That while some Jews at the time bore some responsibility, not all Jews in all places and all times should bear that castigation. And that created a major change in Catholic religious education. And from that, a number of Protestant communions also picked up the idea that, gee, maybe we're not doing such a good job by suggesting that Jews are damned forever.
You also mention as problematic the Gospel of John. I mean, it's one of the central Gospels of Christianity, and you know, it's widely regarded as the most literary of the Gospels. How would you like to see the Gospel of John reinterpreted?
I'm not inclined to take a razor blade to certain passages of the Gospels and say we can't read these anymore. But I think it's helpful if we do a little bit of historical contextualization. Indeed, if Christians claim to love Jesus, one would think they would want to know something about the time and the place where he lived. And if they claim the Gospels as some sort of inspired scripture, then we need to know something about the agenda of the authors, because they're not simply divinely dictated. John has some absolutely beautiful material in the text, like God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. That's terrific. It also refers to Jews as children of the devil, and it tends to be very dualistic. There's, in effect, people who are on the side of Jesus and everybody else, and those people who are not part of the side of Jesus are part of the side of the devil. So what do we do with this material? We acknowledge it. We try to locate it within its historical context, probably, indeed, since the earliest people we would call Christians, a word that's rarely used in the New Testament, are mostly Jews, but they're Jews who believe the Messiah has come. We can see part of this concern is an in-house document. And the closer you are, the more rancorous that relationship can be. And we recognize the harm that the verses have done over time.
Aren't these all Jews, though, talking to each other at the time?
In a number of cases, probably so. We cannot, as historians, be entirely confident about the identity of the gospel writers. The names Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are attributed to the texts after the texts are produced. We do not know exactly to whom these texts were written. We know they go Gentile very, very quickly. So this may be Jews arguing with other Jews, as we find, for example, the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are not great fans of, say, the Pharisees or the Sadducees. We find similar invective or polemic in the same groups when they start splitting into sectarian movements. I mean, some of the worst things that were ever said about Catholics were said by Protestants, but it's still part of the broader Christian tradition. So, yes, some of this material is certainly in-house argument. But especially when the Gospels become part of the Gentile church, then it's all Jews are terrible, and people lose the sense of that original Jewish context.
You've become increasingly concerned over the last decade and more about, let's just call it maybe the casual anti-Semitic language that is often perhaps unthinkingly used from pulpits, in sermons, in homilies. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about our capacity, the capacity of those outside of Jewish communities, to become a little bit more careful, a little bit more reflective, and perhaps even a little bit more precise in the language that we casually use?
It's a difficult question. What gives me optimism is the ability of many people today to recognize the problems that we've had with racist language or with sexist language. So we watch ourselves. And if we can train ourselves to do that, we might be in a better position to avoid some of the easy anti-Semitism that's not really based in deep-seated bigotry. It's based either in ignorance or in tone deafness. So I spend a good deal of my time talking to Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox groups about how to talk about the Pharisees, about how better to preach the New Testament, the Gospels, so that the message to the congregation is not, thank God we're not like those Jews, or those Jews are terrible. So it requires education. The Australian Catholic Church has done a wonderful job of this in terms of its general education for people who teach and preach. Would that the rest of the world were caught up as far as you are.
That's Amy Jill Levine. She's the University Professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies Emerita at Vanderbilt in Nashville, Tennessee.
This is Big Ideas on ABC Radio National with me, Andrew West, and Scott Stevens, and we're unpacking the origins and the spread of anti-Semitism right up to today. As Christianity spread across Europe, the Jews were viewed with suspicion, even contempt. But in the Middle Ages, something deepens this animosity, and the flashpoint is Easter. Who has the special relationship with God? Magda Teta is Professor of Judaic Studies at Fordham University in New York.
Your listeners perhaps already know Easter is a very polemical period for Jews and for Christians. But in the 12th, 13th centuries, we see a reconfiguration of the liturgy and of Easter rituals, but also of devotion to Jesus, moving away from Jesus as God and divine figure to the suffering of Jesus and devotion to his suffering and his humanity. And because this theology of Jewish involvement in Jesus's death and even blaming them for his death became really central, the iconography develops at the time, showing Jews as the ones crucifying Jesus.
But there's also something fascinating here, though, Magda, about the Easter celebration, particularly of what's commonly known as the Holy Communion, which involves, for Catholics at least, the consumption of the body and the blood. How is this connected to what ultimately became the blood libel?
Yes, so there are several of these things happening at the same time. So that shift in focus to the suffering of Jesus. Then the first accusations and legends emerge that Jews are reenacting the crucifixion in killing Christian boys. Later on in the 13th century, when, as you say, there is the doctrine that becomes sanctioned by the Catholic Church, that the communion wafer at the moment when the priest consecrates it turns into the actual body and blood of Christ. That translates to an accusation that Jews desecrate the host, the communion wafer, and when they don't have it, that they actually try to prepare that communion by killing Christian children and getting the blood out of them and then adding it in a Passover matzah. A total fabrication because the Passover matzah is made only from water and flour, but it became a very pernicious legend and the blood libel was born.
Magda, I'm just wondering, though, there is a biblical prohibition against Jews consuming blood, and yet you have these myths, these pernicious legends, not just of Christian children being killed, but also their blood being consumed. It's almost as if there's a double accusation going on here, not just a kind of perversity, but also a hypocrisy about their own religion.
This is also the first time after that blood motif is added to the accusation of ritual crucifixion is a reaction from the popes and from the emperor for the first time condemning Christians for making up such stories. And yet, because this was such a compelling story, grafting on some of the biblical texts, in the Middle Ages, it emerges as a legend, as this kind of lie. But it's really with the introduction of print technology media that it really becomes popular. So,
yes. But Magda, to what extent was this a function of mass printing that started to evolve at the time?
What happens is that in 1475, there is a very ambitious bishop in a town of Trent where a child disappears. And he really understands the power of the new print technology and begins, for the first time, mass propaganda. He prints pamphlets. He commissions poems in Latin, in the vernacular. He sponsored artists to develop the first iconography of Jews killing Christian children. And he makes sure that these stories enter the relatively recent new genre of the chronicles of the history of the world. So when very learned people who would buy these chronicles, they found a dozen of stories that painted these post-biblical Jews as these really horrible, murderous beings.
Why is it, though, Magda, that as we move into the 18th and 19th centuries, which is when Europe is somewhat secularizing, that Jews are continued to be perceived as the enemies of Christians?
That in the Byzantine period, when Roman Empire became Christian, was actually applied into law to show that Jews shouldn't have any superior positions or even equal positions to Christians, that they should recognize through experience that they were punished by God for this awful sin that they supposedly committed, as Christians believed, of killing Jesus. They were put in some parts of Europe in ghettos. They were marked by badges. They were prohibited from certain spaces. They were prohibited from offices and from public positions. So by the time the Enlightenment comes and the sort of idea of equality, everybody equal before law comes, this question about Jews being equal was really problematic for those who advocated for it. And when they were found in public positions, in parliaments, being ministers or in press or other or in business, they were seen as usurping these positions, right? This myth of Jewish power emerges out of that belief that Jews should be as inferior, subjugated socially as well. And that all contributed to this rise of political anti-Semitism, of racial anti-Semitism, and ultimately stories of Jews killing Christian children were used by Nazis to justify the Holocaust.
And in fact, you just raised the issue of Jewish power, suspicion about Jewish power. In fact, as you also alluded to there, the other thing that arises during this period, when so many Jews, in order to be welcomed into, in order to gain entry into civic life or into political or economic life, themselves felt that they were forced effectively to convert. The other thing that you have arising during this period is the problem of racial permanence, that even if it looks like they convert, there is something underneath that can never quite be redeemed. Is that in part the origin of the racialization of anti-Semitism?
From the 17th century on, when European global expansion happens, when they really ramp up the transatlantic slave trade, there are these books that are being published that study the religion of the other. And Jews are this sort of first religion, but they present them as sort of the Old Testament Jews. So having animal sacrifices to show this kind of primitivism. So this racialization of Jews as non-Europeans, as others, as primitive, really happens out of the study of religions and Judaism and other religious groups. So yes, yeah, so it emerges of that sort of Enlightenment scholarship, really. Mm. In the same time that anti-Black racism emerges from that contempt for Black people emerges, seeking to justify the transatlantic slave trade at the time when these ideas of equality and toleration, religious and otherwise, emerge.
Yeah.
By the time we get to the French Revolution, Jews are already cast as, you know, not really belonging, as being the increasingly racialized other.
That was Magda Teta, Professor of Judaic Studies at Fordham University in New York. She mentioned the death of Simon of Trent from the 15th century, but this story, it didn't end there. I think an entire cult developed around his martyrdom, didn't it, Scott?
Yes, that's right, Simon. An entire cult did form around the story of the death of two-year-old Simon Unverdorben. And it spread like wildfire, not just because of the salaciousness of the story, but it also spread off the back of the newly invented printing press, so that we didn't just have the story being circulated, but we also had images, depictions of the martyrdom of Simon. Those images would then become the template for so many anti-Semitic cartoons, for instance, in Nazi propaganda like Der Stürmer. And then we even see a reference to Simon of Trent pop up in the manifesto of a shooter who targeted a synagogue in San Diego in 2019.
This is Big Ideas on ABC Radio National with me, Andrew West, and Scott Stevens, and we're unpacking the origins and the spread of anti-Semitism right up to today.
We've talked about anti-Semitism and the rise and spread of Christianity. But Christianity isn't the only religious tradition that has a fraught relationship with Jews and Judaism.
Indeed, from the very beginning, Islam has wrestled with this as well. Ardis Juderia is Associate Professor of Islamic Studies at Griffith University. Ardis, welcome to our program.
Thank you so very much for having me.
We're exploring the long history, the difficult history at times of anti-Semitism and its roots in religion. And of course, it covers many religions. How would you characterize the relationship between Jews, Christians, and Muslims from the very start?
Complicated. There were ups and downs. There were episodes of, you know, reconciliation and proximity and kind of, you know, efforts to find common ground, but also tensions, conflict, and unfortunately violence. During the formative period of Islam, even after the death of Muhammad, there wasn't a fully crystallized Muslim identity as such. Mm. The region within which Islam emerged was already saturated by Jewish and Christian theological and folklore kind of beliefs. Muhammad himself seems to have been reasonably well acquainted with many of the beliefs of so-called people of the book. The Quran refers to the Jewish and Christian communities.
But I'm wondering if they did see themselves as competitors for God's favor.
Well, there are Quranic verses that show positive attitude towards the Jews and the Christians, even extending arguably salvation.
There are problematic verses, challenging verses, though, in the Islamic texts. I mean, what do they say, for example, about people incurring God's anger, striking them down with humiliation? I mean, these are texts that I think are politicized and mobilized, maybe sometimes with lethal intent.
Yeah, there's no denying of that. Quran 9.29 is definitely one of the most troubling verses in the Quran that talks about fight or kill those who do not believe in God in the last day, and those who forbid what Allah has made permissible and so on and so forth. There's one particularly troubling hadith talks about, you know, one of the things supposedly going to happen is that, you know, Jews will be hiding behind the rocks and trees, and as trees are, and rocks are going to speak out and say, oh, there is a Jew hiding behind me, come and kill the Jew. So extremely troubling texts that must be acknowledged.
And how would you muster the argument against that interpretation?
So, for example, the jihadists picked up on this verse 9.29, and they said that this verse was apparently revealed very late in so-called Medinian period of Muhammad's mission, and therefore it cancels all the other verses that talk favorably. Mm. Now, this is, of course, an interpretational kind of move. The Islamic tradition itself came up with this concept of abrogation or naskh that, again, these jihadists are tapping into and saying that this is the actual Quranic approach to the religious other. But someone like myself would say this is definitely an interpretational move that is not inevitable. The text has a vote, not a veto. And I think this is a common issue that any text-based religious tradition and the people who kind of consider themselves to belong to that tradition have. And at the end of the day, we have a responsibility as the interpreters and the inheritors of this tradition to make ethical choices.
How do we get around, though, this idea that's been invoked by extremist groups, most particularly the Islamic State group, that something is not simply an offence to us, that you are not simply our enemy, but you are God's enemy?
Unfortunately, and I think this is, again, a feature especially prominent in Abrahamic religions in pre-modern kind of medieval times, the concept of God's sovereignty, and therefore what's required of believers is to obey God. And we've seen it, a particular interpretation of this concept was popularized in the modern era by Sayyid Qutb to justify jihadist Salafi interpretations of the Quran. And we've seen this trend, this kind of jihadist militant kind of approach to the Quran has existed from the very beginning of the tradition. You know, the Quran has always been used as a weapon against not just non-Muslims, but Muslims who think differently. There's a famous episode very early on in Islamic history where two Muslim groups, you know, they were engaging in violence and they were trying to come to some kind of a peace. And one group referred to the Quran to justify their position or to basically suggest that they are the ones who are right. And then Ali, who is the cousin and son-in-law of Prophet Muhammad, basically said that Quran is but a text. It's a book between two covers and it cannot speak for itself. It is human beings who speak through the text, which kind of can be used as and has been used by reformist and progressive-minded Muslims to say that even if we accept this idea of God's sovereignty, inevitably the scripture itself is in need of interpretation. And the Islamic tradition has always recognized the fact that the scripture is in need of interpretation. It is, to some extent also, it recognizes the need for contextualization. What I said in relation to the intra-Muslim conflict would carry on into the inter-religious context where we've had Muslim groups who were more open to the religious other, and there were ones who were always more puritanically minded, always eager to maintain strong boundaries. And the later on crystallized Islamic orthodoxy invested heavily in this idea of developing clear markers of Muslim identity, I guess separated itself from already existing religious communities who had well-established intellectual traditions. So Muslims were encouraged not to imitate the unbelievers through particular ways of dress, not engaging in certain practices that are associated with established communities.
Addis, one of the things that we've been exploring is the way that certain religious teachings and certain religious texts get in between real people. Mm. Are there resources within the Islamic tradition that open up possibilities of dialogue, of mutual understanding?
There definitely are. If we just look at it from the, you know, looking at the Quran itself, Quran does not have a single story to tell. There are competing, at times mutually opposite, you know, verses. But there are verses that talk about that Muslims believe in the same God, and they share the same revelation from God that goes back to Abraham. It asks Muslims to show respect and affection for Jews and Christians, so-called Ahl al-Kitab. Arguably, Quran also, in certain Quranic verses, recognizes the scriptures of Jewish and Christian communities. It also urges for respectful dialogue. There is a famous Quranic verse that talks about the need to protect churches and synagogues. Arguably, Quran 2.69 even extends salvation to Jews and Christians. But for someone like myself, I would like to go beyond texts. And in one of my op-eds that I wrote for ABC Religion and Ethics, I asked this question of what kind of God is ethically worth believing in. And so we could apply that test to our understanding of the scripture.
That was Ardis Juderia, Associate Professor of Islamic Studies at Griffith University. He mentioned his writing, Scott, and you have assembled a treasure trove of articles on anti-Semitism and social cohesion, including the one by our next guest.
Yeah, he points out that anti-Semitism isn't simply an ancient religious hatred. It's been embedded in Western politics and law for centuries. Jeffrey Levy is someone who can help us navigate this difficult terrain. He's dedicated his career to understanding the experience of Jewish minorities in modern Europe.
This is the origins of the Jewish question. The rise of the nation state, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen in France, and that question essentially concerned whether and on what conditions Jews should be admitted as citizens. And there were essentially three propositions put in the debate. One, as expressed by Voltaire, was that Jews should reform their religion first before they're given civic equality. You know, they should give up their segregationism, as he put it, and their obscurantist religion. The second position, that they should be given rights first and then reform their religion. This is the position of, for example, Christian Wilhelm von Dom in his famous essay on the civil improvement of the Jews in 1781, or as Abbe Gregoire in the National Assembly debate of 1789 put it, you want Jews to be loyal to a country, to our country, first give them one. Mm. And the third position was that this is a no-go. The Jews are incorrigible. They can't possibly be admitted as citizens. Johann Michaelis, a Bible scholar, pointed to the fact that courtesy of their kosher laws and the fact that they observed the Sabbath, they would make for very poor servicemen in the military, and they were too short to be good soldiers. So for that reason, they shouldn't be admitted. And Johann Fichte, the German philosopher, put it very dramatically. He said that the only way that Jews could be admitted as citizens, if we first cut off their heads and put on new heads in which there is not a single Jewish idea left. His worry was about constituting a state within a state.
But in the 19th century, the 1800s, this transformation affected the Jewish community itself, though, didn't it? I mean, this was the era when, as you say, or as we say, we had that flowering of emancipation, but it was also a two-edged sword for Jews because it was about assimilation. But how did it actually fuel another form of anti-Semitism?
Perhaps counterintuitively, looking back, Jews entered modernity and citizenship with relish, many of them. They were very keen modernizers. Many of them did assimilate very successfully. And in fact, the story of Jews in 19th century Germany has sometimes been said that it's the story of Jewish success and German disappointment. So Jews were very successful economically, professionally, in the universities, in the professions, sometimes perceived at the expense of their German brethren, and that caused a lot of resentment.
And didn't some rabbis even take on the appearance of Christian ministers? In fact, haven't I read where some Jews started to worship on Sundays?
They did that. They embraced various Christian traditions within the Jewish liturgy. They used organ music, for example, in choirs, which had not been a traditional form of Jewish religious worship. So, yes, they imbibed the norms of their society and of the times. They modernized to the point that, in the eyes of the Orthodox, was unacceptable. So there were these internal Jewish disputes within the community.
And what challenge, though, did that pose to the latent anti-Semitism? Because, I mean, this is where we get to the nub of it.
Yes.
And I know that Scott is eager to explore this as well, but what challenge did this assimilation pose to this bubbling anti-Semitism?
Well, courtesy of this resentment, but also courtesy of these ideas about racial superiority that were percolating in 19th century Europe, which actually go back to the early 19th century. Somebody like Count Gobineau, who was a French writer and diplomat, was talking about the superiority of the Aryan and Nordic races. Darwin, of course, writes, is on The Origin of the Species, 1859, and his ideas are exploited in terms of social Darwinism, trying to create a hierarchy among the races. And it's probably not coincidental that just as the Jews were successfully assimilating and losing their distinctiveness, both in terms of their practices and in terms of their dress and their appearance, a new form of anti-Jewish prejudice arose, something that couldn't appeal to their Jewish practices, but what it did appeal to and what joined all Jews was the blood that ran through their veins. This is the biological racism that is known as anti-Semitism.
And Jeff, you do have two things, it seems to me, running hand in hand here that are really quite troubling. One is the purported scientific basis for racism, the fact, if you like, of an inferior race. But then you also have the problem that was presented by the requirement that many Jews needed to effectively convert to Christianity in order to gain entry into Christian society, which then meant that there was this remainder, there was this thing that was non-convertible or irredeemable. It almost seems as though the scientific and the religious here were going in a really uncomfortable way hand in hand.
Yeah, and the differences here, for example, in Germany, Jews could organize collectively, but they couldn't enter the state, as you point out, unless they converted. But in France, they could be officers of the state without converting, but they couldn't really organize collectively. You know, French republicanism meant that you needed to respect civil equality by kind of hiding your private identities. There are these tensions between the old anti-Jewish prejudice based on the condemnation of the Jews as Christ killers and Christ deniers, and then the racial anti-Semitism of the latter 19th century based on pseudo-scientific ideas rather than scientific ideas.
And these things really did come to a head, of course, with the Final Solution in Germany. And, you know, I mean, there remains debate among historians. Doesn't there, about Hitler's own faith. I mean, in his own writings, he says that his favorite passage in the New Testament is the story of that great Aryan Jesus' expulsion of the Jews from the temple. He says, except now in the hands of the Nazi state, it's not the whip, but the blackjack.
Yeah. Yeah, the Holocaust depended on several modern ideas. There's a sense in which it could only have happened at least in the 20th century. One of the things that it depended on was a very extensive bureaucracy for mass extermination. And that really only occurs in the early 20th century and on. The second thing it depended upon was technology. To mass exterminate so many people required new technology. In this case, it was Zyklon B gas. And the third thing it depended on, which wasn't new, was political will. It's sometimes said that Hitler, the only thing original about Hitler was not his ideas for mass extermination, but he went ahead and did it. But also there are modern ideas. I mean, you alluded, Scott, to Hitler's favorite passage, which is really a sort of classical anti-Jewish prejudice. But it also depended on this idea of the purity of the ethnic nation.
Yeah.
And that's a modern idea, that for a state to be successful, especially if you believe in the superiority of your ethnic group, of the ethnic majority, it needs to maintain its homogeneity, and therefore any minority group represents a threat. And I might just add here, this: it's sometimes said that modern Jewish history has two terminal points. 1781, which is the date of the essay on the civil improvement of the Jews by Christian Wilhelm von Dohm, in which he argues for Jewish civil equality. So that terminal point, in shorthand, could be called total assimilation. And the second terminal point is 1942, the Von See Conference, where the final solution is thought through and administered. And it's said that between those two terminal points, there's a common assumption, and that is the elimination of Jews as a discernible entity on German soil. And there is something to that argument. They're both engaged in the disappearance, if you like, of Jewish distinctiveness. The caution I would add is that there's a world of difference between assimilation and extermination. Mm-hmm.
Towards the end of the 1800s, we have the birth of a modern Zionist ideal under, you know, coming out of the writings of Herzl. How much was there a clannishness, if you like, among Jews that arose in response to two things, the bubbling, persistent anti-Semitism, but also the fear that we may disappear. We're becoming too integrated. We may disappear as a distinct people.
Yes, there's an interest in Jewish self-preservation and the continuation of Jewish culture and identity. Zionism arises first in Eastern Europe among thinkers. And that had to do with the very dire circumstances under Tsarist Russia, Prussian pogroms and so on. But it also, not long after, took root in Western Europe. You mentioned Herzl. I mean, Herzl attends the Dreyfus trial.
And Dreyfus was a brave man, a military hero, and he was still not accepted.
Exactly. And that's where he finally came to the conclusion that it doesn't matter what Jews do in the West, they're not going to be accepted. So that was Herzl's awakening. And so the conclusion was that the only solution to the Jewish predicament in Europe was for them to remove themselves and have a homeland elsewhere. And then the debate turned to where? And the obvious place was to the ancestral Jewish homeland in Palestine. Mm. But Herzl was a pragmatist. I mean, he considered Uganda, for example, as a possible place, just as a safe haven.
This is relevant today as we bring this exploration of anti-Semitism and its religious roots as we draw it to today's Australia. You say there's two racisms that are still directed at Jews. They're both pernicious, but they're very different. One is obviously the classical anti-Semitism that we have explored in this program. But you also talk about something called groupism. What is groupism?
It's a general phenomenon of expressing one's hostility or objection to what's going on overseas by targeting people who are assumed to be collectively responsible for those events. Very widespread. So, for example, in the wake of COVID, Asian Australians were often the victim of hostility based on the view that COVID originated in China, for example. We see it visited upon Muslim and Arab Australians in the wake of Middle East events or international Islamist terrorist attacks. Of course, we've seen it in the wake of the Israeli war in Gaza, visited upon Jews.
What's the lesson for 21st century Australia, especially as we engage in this deep searching process that the Royal Commission hopefully will be? What lessons does Australia learn today from Europe?
Well, big question. There's an argument made by Jewish leaders that the phenomenon of something like groupism can't be distinguished from anti-Semitism proper. It can't be disentangled. And I think there's something to that proposition. What I would say is that many people have been motivated in their expression of objection and opposition, sometimes with heat in the moment, without any underlying anti-Semitism. They are expressing their revulsion and their objection to what Israel has been doing in Gaza. So I think one can distinguish between the two. But what I would also add is that even if we can't disentangle them entirely. Even if we grant the argument, they're always connected. I would say that we should not try to come up with the antidote to anti-Semitism. We should not allow the ideal to get in the way of treating the symptoms when we might be more successful in treating the precipitating and catalytic factors related to international events. I think we can, you know, walk and chew gum at the same time. And the point I would make is that in multicultural Australia, we're not really taught how to deal with these differentiations at school. We're left to our own devices to sort out when is it okay to generalize about a group and to collectively associate people with a group, and when is it not okay. And I think our curricula could do a better job of educating for multicultural Australia in that respect.
Great to speak with you. Jeff Levy, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of New South Wales. He established the Jewish Studies program. Thanks for being part of this program, Jeff.
Pleasure.
This is a special episode of Big Ideas from the Religion and Ethics team. I'm Andrew West. Scott Stevens and I have been charting the origins and the growth of anti-Semitism and how it affects all of us today. I thought we should end this special episode of Big Ideas with someone who grew up a very long way from here in a very different environment. For more than 20 years, he's dedicated himself to fighting all forms of cultural and religious prejudice. Rabbi Zalman Castell is the founder and now the dean of Together for Humanity. Zalman, the bushland, it's alive with birdsong, and there's probably the odd lethal animal around here. That's Australia. It's a long way from Crown Heights.
Absolutely. No squirrels here, but otherwise, fantastic. You can see wallabies here early in the morning when I walk here. I'm very grateful to be here away from Brooklyn.
No one can really ever put their finger specifically on Australian values. To the extent that we know what Australian values are, how can we use them to fight anti-Semitism?
Australian values, to me, are about reasonableness. We pride ourselves on being pretty practical people. We don't go in for those kind of old prejudices that in some places are deeply embedded. We think of ourselves as, you know, to use the cliche, the fair go, where see people as equal. The beautiful side of the tall poppy syndrome is that we actually are quite a humble people and we value dignity for all.
But one of the reasons that I wanted to speak to you is that over the past two decades, I would lose count of the number of kids that you have worked with. First of all, how many kids have you worked with in these programs to reduce prejudice?
Yeah, look, in the last 3 years alone, 129,300 students have been affected by Together for Humanity programs, 18,200 teachers, 9,200 parents and community members, working with 442 schools.
We can't put the burden of fighting anti-Semitism wholly on schools. But what do schools need to do? What are you trying to impart?
There are a couple of things that really matter. One is positive contact. A lot of young people have never met a Jew or a Muslim or Aboriginal person before. And if you don't have that contact, other things fill that void. So we'll go into a school with a diverse team, you know, when we can, with a First Nations person, generally with a Jewish person, a Muslim person, a Christian, or migrants for a Khmer, you know, various other backgrounds, depending on who's available in a particular place. And play with a conversation. Which of us is Australian? I think back to Bullsbrook in WA. We went in there with a Lebanese Muslim sheikh in a turban, and we asked them to guess which of us was Australian. There was one Christian man with dreadlocks and, you know, white skins, and he was picked as Australian. I wasn't because I was Jewish, and they couldn't imagine that you could be both Jewish and Australian. And certainly the guy with the turban clearly was not Australian. And then we asked them to think about what do we mean by the word Australian? Is it citizenship? Is it some kind of way of being? And one of the students suggested that maybe it's about hanging out in the pub with your mates after work and having a beer. And there'd been a boy there who'd been in trouble for some racist incident, and he piped up and said, hang on a second. According to that definition, I'm not Australian either because I'm underage and I can't drink. You know, so it's really challenging, you know, encouraging curiosity, critical thinking in a playful way. But another thing that happens in schools is all of us are spending, all of our young people are spending a lot of time there. And often what we're seeing is very specific perspectives and not the other perspective. Whose voice are you not hearing? How much of the picture are you really seeing?
What does school curricula need to contain?
Well, to some extent, it's already in there. So they have general capabilities. There's a personal social capability. But also, it'd be really helpful. They used to have in the curriculum here learning about different worldviews or different kinds of people. That's kind of fallen out with the Australian curriculum. It used to be big in New South Wales. In Victoria, they're trialing it. Non-religious people, as well as a few different religious communities in the trial in Victoria, they're going with 8 worldviews, including Jews, Muslims, Sikhs, and humanist, Christian, Buddhist. I'm not sure what all of the 8 do. I guess is probably the other one of that set. So empathy is critically important. Putting yourself in another person's shoes. Imagine what their experiences are like of everyday life, but also as it relates to particular things. How does a Jewish child experience Hanukkah or Passover? How does a Muslim child experience Eid or Diwali? Just really understanding both our similarities and differences across worldviews. And I think for a lot of religious people to understand that non-religious people have deep values and virtues as well.
We've spent much of the last hour excavating religious texts.
Mm.
For Jewish people, there's some very confronting language in those texts, language that over centuries has motivated anti-Semitism. What do you see in the texts, though, that can rescue interfaith relations?
Look, read texts often as we are rather than the text themselves. I mean, texts can be read in so many different ways and emphasizing one bit and kind of quickly moving on from other bits or applying them in a very narrow way. So, I mean, I think engaging with text is important to think about because we need to be intentional about the way text is read. I've been talking to a Carmelite monk about a text that's really important to both of us because they're very connected to Elijah. And, you know, in that text, we have a very angry Elijah who ends up in a cave. And God says to Elijah, what are you doing here? And he says, well, the people have done evil and he's full of outrage. And God then shows him this vision of fire and earthquake and storming and says, look, you know, maybe tone it down a little bit is the kind of implicit message. But Elijah doesn't get that message. And when God asks him the identical question, he repeats the same 24 angry words that he said at the beginning. And when I read that text, I see it as an invitation because what God says to Elijah is, I'm not to be found in the fire. I'm not to be found in the earthquake. I'm not in the noise. I'm not in the wind. I am in a sound of silence. A thin, fine sound of silence. And it's an invitation to me and to believers to sometimes once we've processed the anger, processed the grief, to go to something quieter.
It's a very poignant way to end this discussion. Rabbi Zalman Castell from Together for Humanity, thank you very much.
It's a privilege to be here.
And that's where we end this special episode of Big Ideas. We've been looking at the origins and the spread of anti-Semitism, which still plagues us. But we also wanted to leave you with a sense of hope about how our country and our world can overcome it. Thanks to my colleagues, Scott Stephen, Sinead Lee, Anita Barrow, Simon Nicholas, James Carlton, Harvey O'Sullivan, and our executive producer, Noel Debien, and also to the Big Ideas team. I'm Andrew West.
And big thanks to guest hosts Andrew West and Scott Stephens from ABC Religion and Ethics and their guests. And we always love hearing from you. Your reflections, share them. Email bigideas@abc.net.au. And you can hear today's show and share it with others. Just look for Big Ideas on ABC Listen or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. Hear Andrew on ABC Radio National's weekly Religion and Ethics Report. Here's Scott, co-hosting The Minefield. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Look forward to your company next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.